Janelle Choxel.
I work at the Drawing Center. My name is Kagan. I'm going to hand it over to Paul, and he's going to host the event from here on out.
We are gathered here today. Thanks, everyone, for coming out, and I think Tom, Monica, Tim, if you want to come and have a seat up here, so we're all like a panel, but we'll try and keep it fairly informal. Trisha, no. Trisha's really sick.
I'm not sick. Heroically. I just feel like shit.
Okay. We're all going to talk for maybe 3 to 5 minutes or perform or do something. I kind of tricked the panelists into not telling me what they were going to do, and I didn't really tell them what we were going to do. And that's kind of intentional informality, so that hopefully we can have a bit of a discussion later. And so I'll just say a little bit about the journal, and then each of the contributors will say a little bit. I should also say it's a bit haphazard and last minute. It's a little bit like the Snowden situation with Convolution. It was held up in customs, and it's been at the Newark airport for the last 48 hours. And I, in fact, just drove to the Newark airport and arrived here at 4:30 with these copies, which were printed in Croatia and really a bit about the sort of history of the journal and just to give you an idea of where we're coming from. So with a couple of friends of mine, Janelle Troxell and Robert Weston, we were graduate students at Columbia studying literature and sort of thinking about what didn't exist for publishing about literature and art. And we were frustrated that academic writing, very interesting to academics, and really, there's one main genre, or two main genres for academic writing, the 10,000-word scholarly essay or the full-length book monograph. And it seemed to us that we ourselves and many of our friends, acquaintances, or people who we idolized, who we knew at maybe 1 or 2 degrees of remove, didn't have a venue to publish more adventurous, critical, and artistic work. And so we decided to start the journal, and the real turning point was when we connected with this mysterious international underground organization called We Have Photoshop, which is Sebastian Campos, Mike Gallagher, Andrew Schertz, and Rebecca Jimenez. And they, I think, had a similar graduate school experience where they bonded over wanting to do somewhat idealistic design projects, and they happened to be really brilliant designers and to make up for whatever shortcomings we had in terms of finding content or being organized or on time or overworked or underworked. And so, it being in the middle of the summer, it's a little bit hard to get everyone in one place. And I've been texting and emailing actually kind of around the world the past couple days trying to get to this place. And I really wish especially Sebastian Campos was here. He's in Spain. Andrew Schertz is in Louisiana right now. Mike Gallagher is in London. Janelle is in Texas. And in fact, a lot of other volunteers who helped out with the journal, who you can see on the colophon page, are also not able to be here today. If you've had time to look at the journal, you'll see that it's a little bit, it's a little bit user unfriendly. But in fact, it all makes sense and is quite rational if you spend time with it. So the colophon page, or the title page, is actually in the middle. The journal is sort of cut in half, and there you can see information about who worked on this. And of course, I'll thank them quickly: Alan Lucy, Charlie Lanning, Alex Morrison, Maria Tananian, Columbina Zamponi, all helped out with copy editing, proofing. And there's so many people to thank, really, especially Kagan and Nova Benwe, who put this together tonight, a lot of people have been fans and fellow travelers of the journal and have helped out to make it be what it's become. And so, I could go on, I'm going to try not to. The cover article is by Jo Jeon. It's about Korean film. We're quite eclectic in terms of the different fields we cover. Some film, some art, some music, some literature, but generally we don't print straight up poetry, even though that's probably the sort of general bias. Could have invited some other New York-based contributors. James Hoff should probably be up here. Fantastic influence. And there are also some advertisements in this issue. So one, for instance, is for Primary Information, fantastic press. Another is for Truck Books. Another is Petunia, a fantastic French journal. One of the surprising things about editing a journal like this is you come into contact with a lot of people who also edit journals, and that's been one of the most rewarding parts of it. Another great German journal, Ment. We've had events now at the New York Public Library, at Motto Berlin, sort of the MoMA, let's see, a few more logistical things about the journal. 50 copies arrived today by airmail that I went out to Newark to get, FedEx is probably like going to ban me forever as a customer based on my harassment of them for their incompetence. I don't know, might have to switch to UPS or something. And what else? I was getting to, we only really have 30 copies to sell, which might take care of this audience, but if you're a poor student or you want to save money, we're offering a special deal. You can get, if you pre-order a copy, just give us $15 and we'll mail you one in July. I would like to be able to give a lot of these away for free, but it does cost a lot to put together a journal with this kind of production values. And I think one of the things as an editor that I'm most proud of is that we've been able to do really amazing design and production work, and that's difficult to do. That's part of why we're an annual journal, and why it takes a long time for us to get these out, because we're really fortunate that really the designers are incredible. And so this is really also, I think, uniquely the product of editors, designers, and contributors. And I taught a class on avant-garde journals last semester, and one of the mantras that I came up with is that a journal is really a kind of a collectivity. And it's a kind of shifting collectivity over time, and it builds. I mean, people who are readers of the journal, or who are contributors to the journal, or potential contributors to the journal, all have a kind of interest in its vitality, longevity, and I've been really honored also that some of my sort of idols, who are also editors, contributed. Bob Grenier, who has a great show up right now in Williamsburg at South First, edited a fantastic magazine called This, which was a big influence on me. Charles Bernstein was a contributor to the last issue. Bruce Andrews also edited Language Magazine, another huge influence. And so it's really been so much fun to put this together, and it's such a relief that it's almost party time. And so, as I say, I kind of wanted this to be a little bit informal, and so it's a little bit like when you ask people for contributions to a journal, you never quite know what you're going to get. Life is like a box of chocolates. And so I don't actually know what we'll get tonight. Unfortunately, there seems to be a run on Hello Kitty Band-Aids in New York City. They seem to be unobtainable, and so we were going to try and customize each issue with a Hello Kitty Band-Aid. We couldn't do that. But maybe Tricia will have more to say about this.
Do you want me to stand or sit or hook on this?
I wouldn't dare suggest posture.
I mean, well, guys, I like had this whole thing planned, right? But apparently, like, so Paul told me that he doesn't really know what I'm supposed to do, and it's just like, I don't really know what I'm supposed to be doing, and it's just like, so I guess I'm supposed to talk to you about the Hello Kitty Band-Aid. I don't even have the buff. I'm supposed to like give the paper part of this, and like you're all just gonna be like, oh, it's just so fucking bad. I mean, like every time I look at it, I'm just like, oh my god, shut up. Like, I mean, like I was watching my parents watch Jon Stewart the other day, and they were like, oh my god, like there's a crisis of authenticity in this nation. And I'm just like, anyway, but I'm just gonna. I mean, I was just like, I love you, let's fight about it, right? I mean, so I guess the deal about the Hello Kitty Band-Aid, the Band-Aid is. So obviously, like, the main function of the Band-Aid is to keep, like, microbes and other germs and foreign bodies out of, like, a clean body or something like that. So the brown vinyl, like, the quote-unquote pure Band-Aid mimics, like, the color of flesh. And so what it really tells us is that our bodies can be made whole again if there are holes in it, so to speak. I mean, when you think about, quote-unquote, the contemporary Band-Aid, they have, like, pictures of SpongeBob SquarePants on them, and, like, some of them have, like, packaging that says made with unicorn tears for, like, extra healing power. So, I mean, the thing about the Band-Aid is what it says is that it privileges this, like, myth of a healing narrative over the actual healing process itself that's imbued in the sort of, like, material nature of the Band-Aid. So what it actually becomes is a formal emplacement of a narrative onto a wound. Right, so it's like, I guess, like, I always wondered whether nature would permit some kind of, like, exact imitation or initiation or something. I don't know, because, like, have you ever heard of an operation to, like, mend a cat's jaw? I mean, it's kind of creepy, but she's a beautiful animal, right? Like, I'm not really sure if there's a chance there, but, so, like, I guess the feminine wound has been, like, really heavily narrativized throughout history, like, to the point of being overdetermined, like, Freud, right? So, the Band-Aid as a recuperative strip of, like, false flesh or whatever can become a fetish that literally masks the feminine wound as, like, an idealized anecdote or whatever. So, you know, you look down, you see that woman doesn't have a penis, you're like, oh man, she has, like, this big hole. I'm just gonna look at something else. That's basically what a fetish is, right? So, anyway, funny story. So Earl Dickinson, who was the inventor of the Band-Aid, actually, he was, like, this low-level employee, but he was really inspired by the fact that his wife kept hurting herself during the preparation of meals. I think it's a direct quote from some historical book that was like, during the first week that she was married to Earl Dickinson, it seems that Josephine just couldn't stop cutting herself. So, I mean, it's a funny story, but the way that it works is also like this strange paradox, right? Like, so the blood is white. What interrupted her feminine labor, and the Band-Aid is what enabled it, but it's also eventually what pronounces the wound as a sort of substitution. So it's kind of like, it would be kind of like as if the far wall is like a neon pink, like black light painted hard with like a swastika in the middle of it, and like written very small inside of the swastika in like orange, black, like neon points, I guess, or the numbers like 666, and then inside of the middle number 6 are the letters Jesus, but this is like mostly scratched out. So it's like that continuous. Okay, so there's always a trance, right, with like a Tumblr background design, like it's like there's a squeeze cage which is being brought up against the door, and so like a squeeze cage is like a small, strong thing on wheels, and like on one end there's the door sliding up and down, and the two sides are kind of fixed so that, you know, by winding a handle you can kind of close it towards each other or open it up, and like that's like so important, you guys, you know? Anyway, I lost my place. So the Hello Kitty Band-Aid, Hello Kitty is like a symbol for compulsory femininity in a certain way, right? So like that a mouth, she becomes like a symbol of girl culture in representing like the historical silencing of women, and in the case of specifically the Hello Kitty Band-Aid, like the visuality there is made super neon and obscene, and it's like got hearts and flowers and varying shades on it, and it kind of advertises the fact that when it obscures, it's basically like a corporeal horror, right? Like torn flesh. Anyway, so applying the Hello Kitty Band-Aid is this means of making a wound palatable in the sense of its adorableness. But then the wound becomes like very visible in a certain way, because it's like, oh, look, here, under all these stars and hearts, like there is a wound. Which means like sometimes actual rupture necessitates like an object being present, like this journal, to evoke alternative narratives and false like or fantasized continuity. So, you know, the Band-Aid as an object, it becomes like active, and it makes the subject like part of its synthetic materiality. Anyway, so that's basically what the article says, and it's like, you know, when I was a nerd, I used to cut myself and I wore a Hello Kitty Band-Aid. I was just like, you know, I like really need to get like extremely deep in the cut, like I need to like chill there indefinitely, like you guys know what I mean, and everybody's just like, what are you like honey, you're so mainstream, like whatever. Anyway, so anyway, back to cats. You like wire the broken bones together, and then you wire the lower jaw to the upper jaw to keep her jaws clenched and like totally immobile, and then until the bone knits, you feed your cat by dripping milk slowly into the corner of her mouth where like the flesh is loose, and though, you know, numerical sequences may well be reversed, you would have to have men working in two shifts to, like, drip enough milk into her mouth to keep her alive, which is, like, impossible, right? So it's, you know, it's just, like, you have to figure out another way. Anyway, thanks.
Thanks so much, Tricia. I neglected to mention a conspicuous absence. Rodrigo Toscano is on his way from Boston. He may make it, he may not. He might be a late arrival. So in case he does make it, he'll go last. And otherwise, the idea was to go in alphabetical order. And Ton Lin and Diana Kingsley collaborated, so they may speak together, I guess, after Monica, and so I suppose I'll turn it over to you, Monica.
My companion here to the left, Tim, is excited that since we didn't really know what to do, we would talk about Tim's work. So I'm going to
just so we're collaborating too.
Yeah, we're collaborating now.
So I'm going to read you a little bit about a little bit from Tim's contribution, and then maybe as I do this, engage in a little conversation. So we notice that begins with a poem by Hans, a woman called Moisey Zukovsky. And the title is Epic as Epigram, Moisey Zukovsky's A, seen through the reverse telescope of R.M. Soroyan's minimalist poem. So I'll just read the first paragraph first, and then I'm going to intervene it. The first thing to notice is that the two words rhyme awkwardly. The rhyme draws attention to the noisiness of the poem. Its music is not mellifluous, but it is intricate as the title really transmodifies into the word moisey, where the sound moisey then gets distorted in the last line as Olski. The rhyme is an accent and, among other things, evokes the Yiddish of Sikorsky's youth, sounding Sikorsky's complex relationship to English, which I'm imagining right now, you might notice. His second vocabulary language, English in A, goes well beyond the idiomatic analogies of speech toward a synchronous atonal verbal music, some might never less than first register of decimals. The second line was Kosky's both immigrant along the United between the has been the quotation. The name, potential alterity, replaces A by name that significantly the name of its author. The replace conflation, not only in markers that set its addressing, name, speak, present, A as toward the chiasm that as poem and poem is life. Hooking together the name as quotes, Kosky temporalities where the title first as a form only the last identity. On the one unit, Louis, on the other hand, invokes his patrilineal Savoyan identity. Even multiple, that is, a many or two out of many, pluribus unum. The music by calling material artifact or vocalizing the plosives against harmonized, the attenuated dino coupled with the name music, Tchaikovsky's para, of course, entirely arbing about John, his iconic minutes and 30 full of sound. By challenges that auditorium not similarly aid, that alert preconceived ideas of the ways in which to imagine a more gives us language, is not so but apprehending. So while structure and noise into Louis, into cultivating our tuning, music is a cultural and tradition influences our A and poems between about the language questions, in particular into our noisy idea of reading. As in tradition, Edgar Allan, perfect sense of the terms, long epic as still like A, Savoyans attending to the in the details reading of the amplified by the space Combs Park's witness construct out of its music post-orality and an epic smile. Thinking about Sorin's poem Biographical Presence, how the phrase particular apprehension, they also always remains unspoken and Sorin's poem cannot recall what Benjamin would as Tim. Incisive, pithy, and hermetic, there was more expressed readings. What that sense idea that the beyond and destiny, relics of an endlessly excavated, indeterminate cantos, totality, the resistance of meter, by then proverbial, perhaps already itself not echo chamber, both ruins of short leave. Unassimilatively. Written lines of A in A24, it textual translate and play felicitously in T, often fidelity, two down and the epic as a leaving time, on the poem unstated after X experience. Duration of A, Savoyans absorbed by the text writing, reading A. Length of out requires to relatively width of beyond that negative with that in A. LZ, Christie Street, Brooklyn, Avenue South, Port Jefferson.
What do you think? Good summary?
Beautiful. So anyone who's into Robert Grenier or went to that little show, I made these little books. I went to the Robert Grenier thing in Williamsburg. I don't know. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Anyway.
One of our contributors.
Yeah, he's in there. And so one of the things I've kind of become, not really quite, but like a Boswell sort of. So I write these poems when I hear him speak because he just says the craziest, wonderfulest poetic stuff. So someone should be writing this shit down. So I write it down and turn it into poems, and this is the latest little book. If anyone's interested in checking it out, I have a few. I made them at 4 o'clock this morning. I was running out of time. So there's kind of a wardrobe malfunction. But maybe that makes it even more artistic. So the way this book works, begin with it's a, what do you call it, Jacob's Ladder? Kind of opens out like that. Right, so it's a bunch of little Bob Grenier poems. Anyway, that's an advertisement for this, if you're interested, because this is probably the only crowd I can imagine being interested in such an object that you can hold it. All right. So, as Monica said, we just met and are intervening in each other's work improvisationally. And you were what I got from my work through you was the idea of music and translation. And so looking at your piece, I want to try to bring something of that out. Carillon, is that right? This is called Carillon Footnotes. And is this his piece? Right? Did you write that?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to read some of the footnotes, and then I'm going to try to perform the piece that is in parentheticals and dashes. The footnotes start, and I'm not going to read all the footnotes, just the ones I find relevant to contextualize the performance. As seen before, traces of Mexico's mounting social upheaval are palpable in some of the short stories. La Palabras from La Muerte de Miss O deals with the rising repression of Mexico's student movement. One of his characters, after being beaten up by the police, along with other five students, exclaims,
mierda de país, nos negan todos los medios de protesta.
Shit, country! All forms of protest are denied to us. Shit, country. All the forms of protest are denied to us. Neither sonnets nor arguments are paginated. Carillon removed all traces of the source stories and left only graphic signs to represent their musical main structural elements. So it sounds like this. Okay, will this like fuck up the recording? So it sounds like...
You want me to hold this?
I want you to hold this side.
Probably the most elaborate contribution we've ever had to the journal is Han and Diana's, and this was really a lot of fun to work with them in terms of designing and editing it. And it's a, well, I'll leave it to them to describe, but it's full color, 96 pages, an incredible bargain, really, and kind of amazing we were able to pull this off. So, surprise us.
Not possible.
I'm Diana. If I hold that up, can I say I showed with Ken Press? I thought I'd just talk about the genesis of the project, or the book. I had a solo show last year at Castelli, and I had an opportunity to make a book for it. And I thought I had an opportunity to make a book for it anyway, and I invited Tom to write for it. I knew, I've known Tom a long time. I've read a lot that he's written. I knew that it wouldn't be a catalog essay. It would be something more. He would be able to craft a mood around the work, and so I was really excited when he said yes. So, but I don't think he had any idea what he was going to do. All we knew is it was supposed to be about 15 works in this show. So we did a studio visit. He came over. He asked for notes on each piece, and then he would just ask me more questions about each work. He would ask me what the species of every plant in every picture, what if there was a bowl, who gave it to me, where was that person born, what year were they born, when did they die? So he asked me every little detail about, you know, every single element of the pictures. And then he went on to interview me in a more biographical way. He asked me questions like, what did I read in high school? What makeup did I wear in college? What makeup do I wear now? What was the name of the law firm where I was laid off in 2009? You know, read back. how old was I when my mother died? So all this accumulated facts about me, about the work, and I don't know if I had any idea what he was doing with this, but...
I didn't either, though. I mean, when someone asks you to write a sort of catalog essay in an art context, I think most writers kind of just groan, because, you know, you have to write something that sort of fits within the kind of art context that's usually sort of fulfills some publicity mechanism, and I didn't really want to do that, so... And yet I wanted to create something that would sort of also describe the arc of a whole body of work and that could be linked to what we would sort of normally call either an autobiography or a novel. And so I wanted to sort of capture the arc of Diana's life through the photographs, even though the photographs don't specifically reference elements of her life. In some ways, I think she was very careful so that the references to her life are always indirect and sort of hidden, as it were. And yet the tonal colors of the piece I thought were hugely affective, and I wondered, well, how could I access that element? So, I asked Diana tons of questions. I've known her for a long time, but I didn't really know her very well. So I asked her all sorts of questions, and photographs are kind of memento mori anyway in some ways. They sort of capture elements of life at various moments. And I thought, well, we'll try to do an index to a group of photographs, and in that way sort of capture some of the subject matter of the pieces, which is mostly submerged, and you wouldn't know it anyway if you look. I mean, if you look at I was particularly drawn to her attraction to particular colors on furniture. I don't know what the upholstery, her use of upholstery in her photographs I thought was really interesting. So I just wanted to know more about it. And of course it was related to her grandmother's houses that she had lived in. So I wanted to include these things. So we did an index, and I think it's, I wanted the index to function almost novelistically. I wanted you to be able to sort of read it as a kind of suppressed autobiography, and yet I wanted it to tell you something a little bit about the photographs too. So that's sort of that's what I was thinking about when I did it.
And this was really fun to put together. I think we probably spent 10 or 15 hours on Skype with Sebastian, the main designer in Spain.
We tried really hard not to design it.
Right. But say more.
Well, I mean, I wanted to create that sort of very affective thing. I mean, I wanted to create, I mean, it's, we're using a sort of index, a sort of paratextual material to describe, you know, photographs. And usually, you know, you write a sort of essay or tell a story, but I wondered if you could sort of reduce the amount of information needed to describe the various elements or objects in a sort of work of art in this case, and also to convey something of sort of Diana's life story. And, you know, and I wanted to create an index that could, you know, make people cry a little bit. I mean, you know, indexes normally don't sort of make you cry. But I wanted, the challenge to me was like, oh, can I make an index that would actually make people weep? And so that's kind of what I was thinking about. I mean, I wanted a highly affective or emotional index. And, you know, so much information is delivered to us now. And we have to sort of, we kind of try to deal with it in some sort of way, so we tag it. Customize it. There's a huge amount of information now that we try to personalize in some sort of way. So this project fits into that sort of larger, I think, sort of cultural moment where we just have a huge amount of information that we just sort of are bombarded with, and what do we do with it? Well, we try to personalize it. We try to put it to some use. We try to convert it into a work of literature or a novel. So these are some of the things that are going on in this little book. Because it's not really, it's kind of a picture book, but it's also kind of a novel. I'm not sure what the genre is, even. And, you know, it's sort of, Diana and I were sort of working together to do something, to tell some sort of, some kind of, I don't know what we were doing, to tell some kind of story, maybe, I don't really know.
Yeah, I guess I could say something about the structure of it, too. I mean, not every, I don't know if it's clear when we say index what that means, but, I mean, it's written out alphabetically like an index, and some of the entries have numbers that correspond to a picture, but you'll have to flip through and find that corresponding number, so it's a little bit of a jumbled index. I mean, you could read it straight through, or you could actually try to find, okay, clothing choices of Luke, who is my stepson, 38, so then you have to flip through and find the image 38, but, you know, and then you will find Luke. But you don't have to read it that way. But that's sort of, it seems like that's the style of convolution, too, that the page numbers are a little jumbled. It's, but I think if you just read it straight through, it's beautiful.
And I think it really is a great embodiment of what we try to do with the journal, which is to make a print journal relevant and interesting and worthy of coming back to read multiple times. The first issue, I gave it to many people who were quite bewildered by it and said, well, where's the content? What's in here? And but then if they spent 5 or 10 or 20 minutes with it, they started to figure it out and to realize that it's cut like a deck of cards, and in fact, the pages are all rational, and the footnotes are ordered and organized. And our intention was not obfuscation or difficulty for the sake of difficulty, but it was to somehow create a print object that brought together disparate subjects and allowed something that was more than the sum of its parts. And so I'm very thankful to the contributors for having given us such great material to work with, and some of these were, it was also very challenging, and the designers really took care of that. I mean, I was really, this project kept growing, and I kept on thinking it was completely impossible, but it worked, and that took a lot of time on the part of an author, a photographer, a designer, and an editor. And I think to bring people together who are working on these multiple fronts and have similar interests but quite disparate training and backgrounds, something that the journal is doing well, I hope. I suppose we should just open it up to a bit of a discussion, and then we can have wine after. So the longer people talk, the less we get to drink.
So we don't talk, right?
I guess I kind of messed that up. But you know, it's midsummer. I didn't mean to quash discussion in that way. I mean, I'm happy to be praised and to hear about how the journal changed people's lives and how you all want to subscribe and give it to your friends for Christmas and all the rest. But ask us anything. Give us a hard time.
I'll ask a question about Tom and Diana. I work in images and text and the way that they work together, and I've been in the grad school program, so I've gotten lots of feedback. And some of the feedback that I've gotten is that, you know, you really need to avoid sort of duplicating the same information visually and textually, so that you're never repeating yourself, always being more than the sum of the one or the other. Is that something you struggled with? Did you wind up removing text, the duplicated image, or editing the images you showed based on sort of the holistic story you're trying to tell, or is that not something you worry about, which I'm not listening to my peers in the MFA?
Well, I guess Tom, it would be better to answer that, since my photographs were a set thing. I mean, you picked certain photographs that you wanted to work with, but or you eliminated some that you didn't want.
Yeah, I can't remember how we did. How did we edit the
photos? Well, it started out with just for the show, in which I didn't say that the gallery ended up passing on the project, so we made it bigger. And it was originally just going to be 15 images, and then we decided, well, we can make, now that we have time, we can make this as big as we want. And so Ton and I went through some of my images, and I guess we tried to pick things that weren't duplicate. I mean, you didn't want too many flowers. but beyond that, I think I Ton wrote it, and I didn't really have any say. Maybe he actually asked me to throw in a few entries myself. I think Paul, you threw in something as well at the end there, but he then edited or nixed what I added. So it was really Ton deciding. And I don't think when you see it, it's. Some of them might be odd, like a horse might relate to a horse, but I don't think they over-explain the work at all. Or, I mean, I don't know. How do you?
You know, I was thinking about the photographs as one species of information, I think, and the index items are sort of metadata items. It's another kind of information. So you had visual material, you had textual material, and then you had some sort of numerical tagging system that set up the sort of equation between them. And then you had the page number. So it was really sort of how you could relate these three sort of information systems together. So you have a visual system, you have a textual system, and you have a numeric system. And I was just curious how much play we could get and how we could treat the book as sort of an assemblage between those three sort of variables and keep them sort of loose and yet. You know, whenever you do a book with sort of pictures and text, so I think it's always problematic because one of them tends to dominate the other. Usually the text is subordinate to the images. Here we were really trying to think of a way to sort of equalize the sort of information system. And you're playing with metadata in terms of an index in relationship to the sort of source text, but we wanted to sort of dispense with that notion that there was a source text here and set up more equivalence between the sorts. The two elements, or the three elements in this case. I don't know if that answers the question.
I mean, another element was my titles, there was a question because my titles, I mean, I really like titling my work, and it, you know, I think of them as leading you in some direction, how to understand my work. But I didn't want my titles to get in the way of Ton's index. So at one point, we weren't even going to put them in, but. So that's sort of a third textual element in the book. I think we put them at the end, the titles with the numbers. So, but,
Thank you. I thought it was interesting how you said that the first issue of Convolution's organizational principle was essentially shoving your neck, sort of randomness. Would you say that that's the same for the second issue? Is the organizational principle randomness, or is there something, more deliberate, or is it aleatory, or is it heuristic? How do you come to organize the work?
Well, not as random as it might look. We tried several different covers. I mean, the constraint of the cover is that it's just like any other page, except that it has a barcode on it because of, you know, this day and age. But this, in effect, is just a page from Joe Gian's article, and on the back you can see this is another page. So, in fact, I mean, putting together the first issue, I didn't even understand what the designers were describing to me. And it worked out because they know what they're doing. And I follow their lead. I wouldn't say there's actually very much randomness here. I think our design philosophy is fairly, Euro-modernist or something. And that, in fact, in a lot of ways, is like the antithesis of McSweeney's or something. It's actually quite graphically simple. And, I mean, I could go on forever about this, but the evolution of the design of the journal was a lot of back and forth, and this happened, too, at the Ton and Diana book, where we would go back and forth about, well, where should the titles go? Should the titles be in? How big should the numbers be? So, for instance, I had suggested to the designers that, why don't we do something with footnotes? And I had the boneheaded idea of putting them upside down. And they were like, no, that doesn't make any sense at all. But just putting them at the bottom of the page seemed kind of boring. And, in fact, the single column layout of the journal lent itself quite well to putting them in the gutter of the book, which... I'm not aware of any, I don't think I've ever seen another journal that's done that. It's actually quite functional. The notes are all there. You can find them if you want. The titles are in the center. I think from the perspective of an editor with a literary background, to work with designers who are this ingenious at coming up with solutions to eclectic content is really fantastic. I mean, I guess there's actually not... The chance element is actually what you get, and then what you do with it to turn it into something. So I guess that's what I was going for with my my lame Forrest Gump reference.
Right, I mean, it's a smart journal formally, and I like the idea that basically when you encounter this, it's not that you're reading an object. It's, in a sense, you're reading through an object, right? Which is why I liked my essay being in there, because, I mean, the Hello Kitty Band-Aid, it's almost like a ridiculous misreading through an object. It's not, you know, it's a giant mistake, almost. And that's kind of the kind of reading that this journal in itself encourages. But it's smart design. I mean, so this is my article, and it actually looks a lot like my personal Tumblr background, first of all, which I really like. But also, it's, you know, the Band-Aid's about these sort of, like, stock design template narratives being put on a wound, and so, like, this sort of, like, compulsive repetition that makes it actually very difficult to read was a smart choice. So, like, in that sense, like, the form matches up with the content or enhances it in a certain way that I really enjoy, right, which is why it was such a joy. Nice.
Yeah, and we've often just gotten very lucky with the images that authors have given us, too. We always encourage authors to provide us with as many images as they can. There's a great piece, David Levine just came in, has a piece about Rothko, a lot of really interesting images. The cover of our first issue, we got very lucky, and we were able to print an original Duchamp ready-made, that it just so happened that our contributor had this, and again, this is where a collective can really do a lot more than an individual person can. I was very skeptical about using that as the cover, and it's now sort of become an iconic of our first issue. And a lot of back and forth goes into deciding, for instance, what goes on the cover, what image are we going to use, how are we going to break it up. And also, the typography is really remarkable. because the designers really have strong typographical backgrounds. It actually takes a lot of work to lay out the paragraphs and the footnotes in a way that I think is deeply readable, and yet not just the sort of simple conventional ways that, I mean, academic journals are ugly. They're really ugly, and they have much larger budgets than we do. I don't know what they do to their designers to make them so uncreative and uninteresting. But in a lot of ways, we didn't want to look like, I shouldn't name names, I guess, but you know, we didn't want to be October, and we definitely didn't want to be PMLA. Although if you look, there are little secrets in the first issue. For instance, the submission guidelines are actually plagiarized from PMLA. But every time it said PMLA, we wrote convolution. And if you know PMLA, it's sort of the arch professional journal for literary scholars. And, you know, that's too easy.